Today, we hear about the recent arrest of two journalists after they accused police officers of protecting the alleged killers in a massacre in Northern Ireland. And Jay Rayner on 20 years as The Observer's restaurant critic.
Friday the 31st of August started very abruptly with a large knock at the door. My wife jumped up. She said, oh, there were a lot of cars outside. Then there were a lot of police cars outside. I immediately said to her, I said, this is to do with Lochan Island.
This is Trevor Burney, and he's talking about the Lochan Island massacre, the murder of six Catholics back in June 1994.
By the time I got down to the bottom of the stairs, there were already officers swarming through the house, all with boiler suits, with weapons. My children were starting to appear. Freya, the youngest one who was due to go to school, was kind of caught up in the melee. All I can remember is the image of her in her school uniform standing amongst these sort of 6 foot tall police officers with weapons going through our house. A police officer tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if I could go into another room. And when I went into that other room, he said, OK, well, listen, now I want to tell you you're under arrest and we're taking you away.
It wasn't just Trevor Burney. It was Barry McCaffrey too.
I was taken away in a police car. Neighbours, obviously not knowing what's going on. You know, you think the worst at that stage. You must have done something. There's no smoke without fire. And there was one elderly lady, neighbour, she was out walking her dog. And I could just see the panic in her eyes, as, you know, as I passed in the back of the police car. That's when it all was brought home. That's, we were in a very serious position. The might of the state was coming down on us both.
But I do remember as I was being put into the back of the police car, and I said to the detective who was sitting beside me, I says, I don't suppose that the people who massacred the six men at Lochan Island in June 1994 had been arrested this morning.
No, they hadn't. Instead, the police had turned up at Trevor and Barry's homes. They're award-winning journalists who had just made a film about why there's still no justice 25 years after the Lochan Island massacre. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why has new evidence about the Lochan Island killings not led to anyone being arrested, apart from the journalists who brought the story to our attention? So, Barry and Trevor, you were working on the story of the Lochan Island massacres with Alex Gibney, the Oscar-winning documentary director. They happened in 1994. Barry, what was going on in Northern Ireland at the time?
Politically, things were on a knife edge. People knew that peace was within grasp, but people were still being killed. 2 days before Lochan Island, a Republican splinter group had shot dead members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, a loyalist paramilitary group in Belfast. People knew there would be repercussions, there would be reprisals. No one knew or suspected that the actual reprisal would happen in the sleepy village, Lochan Island, 19 miles away from Belfast, that had never seen the Troubles before.
Trevor, take us to the evening of June the 18th. What happened?
In the village of Lochan Island, it isn't really a village. It's a crossroads with a church, a Catholic church on one side, and a little bar called the Heights Bar on the other side of the crossroads. And on that evening, it was full. They were all gathering to watch the match. Ireland football team was playing Italy in a critical World Cup soccer match, which was on in a little small TV tucked away behind the bar. And just into the second half of the match, Ireland scored. Ray Houghton scored an absolute cracker, and the celebrations in the bar were, you can imagine. But not long afterwards, a figure appeared at the door with a balaclava and a boiler suit. In his hand, he had a VZ-58 rifle, a sort of variation of the AK-47, and he opened fire. He fired all 39 bullets that were in the clip He killed six men and he injured nine others.
Police in Northern Ireland are hunting for two gunmen after the worst violence there in months.
11 people in the back as they watch the World Cup on television. Six men are dead.
And Barry, I was quite struck in the film by the archive you had of Sir Patrick Mayhew, who was the Northern Ireland secretary at the time.
My message to them is this. I suppose some of you have families. Let's just picture a future conversation that you may have with your daughter, who asks you what you did in your so-called war, Daddy. And you will say, I killed a man of 87. He was sitting with his back to me. He was watching the World Cup. I shot him dead.
Barney Green was probably the oldest person killed during the Troubles. Another victim was Adrian Rogan. He'd only gone into the bar to collect tickets for a Gaelic football match the next day. None of them had any connection to any paramilitary or terrorist organisation. They were all civilians who died needlessly.
So we're going to talk a bit about what happened after the murders and the police investigation. You mentioned the Ulster Volunteer Force and the idea that people may have been looking to retaliate. Do we know for sure that they were responsible for the attack?
Yes, within a few hours, the Ulster Volunteer Force claimed responsibility.
So, within 24 hours, the police knew who'd carried out the attacks, who was responsible, and they found the car and the weapons used. And these promises were made to bring people to justice. Barry, is that what happened?
The police knew exactly who the main suspects were within hours. The main suspect, his family home, they never go and search it. They never knock on the door. They never try and recover that vital forensic evidence. All the other houses in the road were searched, but not the main murder suspect's family home.
Well, I think that what the police did do, what we know, is that they destroyed the car. We know that they had the weapons, they had the balaclavas, they had the boiler suits. And yet, you know, the evening before one of the suspects was arrested, he got a phone call from the police to say he was going to be arrested.
And Trevor, I understand there was a handwritten letter that even named a suspect.
6 months after the attack on Valentine's Day 1995, a local councillor, a local nationalist councillor, received what he thought was a Valentine's Day card. But when he opened it, it was actually an anonymous letter which set out the writer's understanding of what had happened in the night. And what she said, we know it was a she because she said that her husband had been involved in the attack and she named his two accomplices. This letter was immediately handed to the police. Luckily for us and for the families, the councillor who received it took a photocopy of it before he gave it to police because police subsequently lost that letter and they lost all the opportunity to do any analysis or DNA on the letter.
So look, it's been a quarter of a century now and for a long time the families have been fighting for justice and there's been none. But there was this really big moment in 2016 when the police ombudsman, whose job it is to investigate complaints about the conduct of officers, released a report. What did the report say, Barry?
Dr. McGuire, the ombudsman, he characterised the police investigation as incompetent, indifferent and full of neglect. He highlighted the failures in the handling of the suspects, the exhibits, the forensic evidence, the searches, the failure to make early arrests. And you have to ask why?
Yeah, why?
Because there were informers in the gang, the police had protected them.
Barry's talking about paramilitaries on both sides of the Troubles who were feeding information to the police. Informers became a powerful weapon in the armoury of the British state during the three decades of the Northern Ireland Troubles. Responsibility for running these informers was divided between Special Branch, that's the intelligence gathering detectives of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and the Army's intelligence corps units. These informers were protected by the state. Trouble is, these informers were also often suspected of murder and other serious crimes.
That is absolutely everything to do with informants. Once the police began to get into the business of recruiting informants within the ranks of the loyalists, they then began to collude with those same loyalists in murder, and that is a fact of life now in Northern Ireland. It's a fact that many, many people do not wish to really deal with, do not wish to recognise. The former head of Scotland Yard, John Stevens, was involved in Northern Ireland in the investigation into the murder of the Catholic solicitor, Pat Finucane. John Stevens came to the conclusion that 3 out of every 4 loyalist paramilitaries were informants for one section of British intelligence or the other. That's incredible when you think of there were 3 men in the car who pulled up to the bar and murdered 6 people. You know, we certainly know that one of those people involved in the gang was an informer. Dr. Michael Maguire came to that conclusion. But on John Stevens' figures, it means that several other members of that same gang were working for Special Branch, or you see Special Branch, or British Intelligence, MI5, or Military Intelligence. And I think we still don't know the full story of that.
Dr. Maguire, he highlighted the relationship between the police and the informants and said that that had undermined the murder investigation and that they had been responsible for 2 murders prior to the Loughon Island massacre. The Special Branch had failed to pass on intelligence of their involvement in the previous murders. So crucially, what that said, what Dr. Maguire concluded, was that if police had taken proper action against this gang in relation to the 2 prior murders, that Loughon Island may never have happened.
Has anyone ever been charged?
No, despite all the evidence against the main suspects, nobody has ever been charged, and it's very unlikely now that they will. Now, to this day, the actual only people facing prosecution are Trevor and myself.
And protecting these informer relationships goes to the heart of why Barry and Trevor were arrested. In 2011, the Northern Irish Police Force had released a report which stated that there was no collusion. In the report, all the identities of the suspects and the police officers were protected and redacted. But a year later, in 2012, Barry received pages of the report in the post. And, crucially, they were unredacted. It confirmed everything Barry and Trevor had suspected.
When I started to turn the pages, I really realised how significant this document was. Crucially, what this document did, it contained the names of the main suspects and the main allegations and the evidence against them. This document, it was warts and all.
Do you know who sent you the document?
No. It was anonymous. Whoever sent this document did so for the best intentions, that they believed that the public needed to know that the state was involved in the murder of its own citizens.
So Trevor, you and Barry had information that suggested who the suspect was and what had happened and why it had happened. Why were you arrested?
That's a very good question. During the production of the film, we realised that what we were going to do is name suspects. And that was a moment that for myself and Barry and all the production team were quite concerned about, because there have been very bad examples of people being named in the media who had absolutely nothing, it transpired, to do with what they were accused of. So prior to the film's premiere, I took the decision to go to the police and say, we're going to name these suspects. Have you any concerns about us naming these suspects? Is there going to be any increase to the risk to their lives? We don't believe there is going to be a risk because the names of the suspects have been known. That was 6 months before the film premiered and we never heard anything from the police in response. But what we now know as a result of our arrest is that police are saying that we breached the Official Secrets Act, and in breaching the Official Secrets Act, we raised the risk to the lives of the suspects. But we had alerted the police 6 months before the premiere of the film. They could have injuncted the film. They could have warned us about any dangers that we were...
They did nothing.
They did nothing. They said nothing. On the morning after this film premiered, the police had a choice. They could put their resources into going after the suspects and finally giving justice to the families, or they could put their resources into going after journalists. You've got to ask yourself why they chose to go after the journalists and not after the killers.
And Barry, can you just tell us what it is they're accusing you of, how long you've been held, and have you been charged?
Firstly, that we had stolen the document from the police ombudsman's office Secondly, that we were handling stolen goods. Thirdly, that we had breached a data protection legislation. And fourthly, that we were in breach of the Official Secrets Act.
But I don't understand, because you were sent an anonymous document.
Yes, yes. Well. Firstly, just to...
That doesn't sound like stealing,
yes,
though,
no,
does
well,
it?
Well, I suppose, crucially, what one of the most important things was the police ombudsman, Dr. McGuire, actually came out publicly and stated that he had never made a complaint of any theft to the Police Service of Northern Ireland. That as far as Dr. McGuire is concerned, there is no theft.
Have you been charged?
No, no, we haven't been charged. We were released on police bail on at 9 p.m. on the 31st of August last year. That bail continues. And any time we have to leave or want to leave the jurisdiction, leave Northern Ireland, we have to ask police 3 days in advance. We have to ask police permission.
So it's had a big personal impact on your life?
Yes, on both our lives. I think the impact on our families, because our families never asked for any of this. You know, you still have that sense of guilt that we have put our families through this.
Barry, it really feels as though the families of the Lochan Island victims have been fighting tirelessly for years and years, knowing that they're not going to go anywhere. I mean, you know them. You spent a lot of time with them. How frustrated are they?
I suppose, these are dignified people. The Lochan Island families, they didn't say a word publicly for the first 10 years. Because they believed the police. When the police said to them, you know, we will leave no stone unturned, we will bring these killers to justice.
Time went on, and we chose to stay quiet because that was our nature, that was the nature of this community, just get on with your life. So we waited and we waited, and you know, we were drip fed bits of information, and then after about, I would say, a year, 2 years, it just stopped. There was no contact. And again, we chose just to stay quiet and hope that someday somebody would be brought to justice.
It was only after 10 years that they began to get so frustrated and feeling that they were being lied to that forced them to speak out. And for this last 25 years, they've been fighting and fighting and fighting.
Is this the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of unsolved crimes committed during the Troubles?
Yes, yes. The official statistics suggest that there are 3,000 unsolved murders that have not been properly investigated as a result of the Troubles. So many people were let down by the state because of this need, this feeling that the gathering of intelligence and the protection of informants was more important than giving justice to the victims of violence. And I think Lochan Island is just one in a mountain of atrocities that were allowed to happen.
A lot has changed in the time since Lochan Island. I mean, we've recently found out that a Bloody Sunday soldier will face murder charges.
A decision has been taken to prosecute one former soldier, Soldier F, for the murder of James Ray and for the murder of William McKinney.
Do you think that we are looking at these things in a different way? Or do you think that what's happened to you and Barry just proves that we're never going to get anywhere with this type of case?
Well, I think that we're now getting so far away from the Troubles that it's becoming almost impossible to expect that there are going to be prosecutions of those who were involved. The fact is that the British government have prevented an agreement on the past, an agreement that was finally put to bed, everything that happened before the Good Friday Agreement. And yet that successive British governments have failed to grasp that nettle. Many of the families are not asking for prosecutions. What they're asking for is the truth. And the fact is that the truth is being denied to them. Lochan Island families are one of the very, very few families out there today who've got the truth about what happened to them. And what we're seeing in Northern Ireland is transgenerational. I believe that it's going to be the younger generation. You know, Emma Rogan saw her mother dealing with her father's murder at Loughan Island. It was only whenever she became 18 did she then take up the campaign to find the truth of what happened to her father.
I think I deserve the truth to know what happened. Like, my daddy was only 34. That's not much older than what I am now. Like, he was young. To me, he was old. You know, he had a moustache and he was my daddy. He was old. I was 8. He was not an old man, but, like, and he wasn't. He was 34 years of age. If I don't stand up for him and I don't fight my daddy's corner, who else is going to do it? I want somebody to be held accountable for what happened here.
I think we're going to see that replicated through the generations in Northern Ireland if the past isn't dealt with.
The fact is that despite being more than 20 years since the Good Friday Agreement was signed, this aspect of the past definitely hasn't been dealt with. In the film, the counsellor who received that anonymous letter, Patsy Toman, is asked to read it out loud.
Dear Mr. Toman, I am writing to advise you of certain facts that I think would be of interest to you. In your quest to cage the Loughan Island murders...
He starts, but stops, too fearful to go on.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not going to read it. No, it's... They were after me once, they'll be after me again.
They were after me once, they'll be after me again, he says there. Is there a sense, Barry, that cases like this, these simmering injustices, are the price for peace?
Yes, Claire Rogan, Adrian Rogan's wife, says in the film that she believes, and the Loughan Island families believe, that they were sacrificed for peace. You know, because really, what does it say about society that the state wasn't prepared to protect its own citizens?
Both of you, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anuska.
The Police Service of Northern Ireland asked Durham Constabulary to conduct a criminal investigation into the loss of secret documents. A spokesperson for the force said the focus was on their use in a documentary, resulting in the potential for lives to be put at risk. They added, "We remain persuaded that any subsequent hearing, fully informed, will find in our favour, but will, of course, comply with any instructions which are ordered by the court." No Stone Unturned, the film Alex Gibney, Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney made about the Loughan Island massacre, is available on iTunes. Here at The Guardian, we will continue to follow this story. Coming up, what does 20 years as a food critic teach you?
Hi, I'm Will Dean, editor of The Guardian Weekly. Since you're a Today in Focus listener, there's a good chance you'll love The Guardian Weekly. It's The Guardian's essential weekly news magazine, featuring a carefully curated selection of Guardian and Observer journalism to give you a global perspective on the issues that matter. You'll find leading opinion writing, analysis, long reads, and cultural coverage from around the world with free worldwide delivery. So, if you think globally, now's the perfect time to start reading weekly. Visit gu.com/TIFGW.
Welcome back. Now Jay Rayner offers his advice about eating out after 2 decades reviewing restaurants for The Observer.
I never intended to be a restaurant critic because who would actually dream about being paid to go out for dinner and write clever things about it? Until 1999, I was a general news and feature writer on The Observer. And I was out for lunch with the editor of The Observer magazine who said this job was coming up. And in that instant, I said, well, that's a job you can't apply for, but I'd love to do it. My mother had introduced me to restaurants when I was a kid. I've always loved the theatre of them. I'd always read other people's restaurant reviews. I spent my own money in them. And what attracted me to the idea was it was a specialism. I thought it was about time. I'd been a journalist for over a dozen years. I needed a specialism. One of the things that has been very popular, certainly over the last 5 to 10 years, despite the mockery of it, is the apparent need to serve food on things that are not plates. It started with people serving food on slates. Have you ever listened to the sound of a knife dragging across a roof slate? It's not pretty. ribs, spare ribs, served in a mini galvanised dustbin because it's obviously it's junk food. How funny. I've had bread served in a flat cap in a Yorkshire restaurant. Items served on novelty things drives me nuts. When it comes to what to choose on a menu and how to get it right, one of my tips is don't necessarily be suckered into the thing that's been boxed away on the top right of the menu. It's a classic menu writing trick to put a box, thin lines around the side, on the top right with a couple of slightly more expensive dishes. Psychologists have proven that your eye will be drawn towards it. Do not add any extra weight to what's in that box. It is just a way to flog things, particularly those which are high margin. Go at lunchtime. Lunchtimes are a very good time to go because the menus tend to be cheaper. Most of the high-end restaurants, the really expensive ones that you think are completely out of your reach, often run a menu that is much, much more affordable at lunchtime. And if you care about your food, you want that experience, it may actually be in your interest to take a day off work so that you can experience it. But the main thing that people should do if they want to get the best experience out of a particular restaurant is go there regularly. The best treatment is given to the regulars. Those are the customers they want. If you turn up once and think that you're going to get the best table in the house just by asking for it, well, your dreams are likely to be shattered. But if you're the person who goes and goes again and goes again and becomes familiar to the waiters, I mean, obviously don't go unless you like it, but if you do like it and you go a few times and you give them your business, you will become a part of, I suppose, the family. And that's how you get the best table. If something happens that you don't like, complain there and then. Do not sit there on your hands getting angrier and angrier and angrier and then storm off into the night and write a furious letter. Raise it the moment it happens, raise it politely and see how they deal with it. And if they don't deal with it properly, don't go back. It's very simple.
You can read Jay Rayner's piece about 20 years of reviewing restaurants for The Observer at theguardian.com. My thanks to him and to Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey. Today's episode was produced by Lucy Greenwell, Rose Della Rabiti, and Nicola Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.